It's 9:06. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today on the Ideas Network. Well, did you ever wonder where all the cash ends up that pays for illegal drug trafficking? Probably not. Well, I'll tell you what, we're talking about trillions of dollars in cash worldwide, according to some estimates. The World Bank and International Monetary Fund estimates that global money laundering linked to corruption, criminal activity, and tax evasion constitutes about 3 to 5% of the world's gross domestic product, or between roughly 2.17 and 3.61 trillion, that's trillion with a T, dollars a year. Some law enforcement officials are saying that if we want to shut down the drug lords, we have to turn off the money. Others are saying it may already be too late. Well, that's what we're going to talk about this hour. Joining me is Peter Henning, professor of law at Wayne State University. He also writes the White Collar Watch blog at the New York Times. Professor Henning, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for being here. I think it would probably be a good idea if we put some definitions around some terms here concerning money laundering. In general terms, we're talking about taking illicit cash and turning it into something that can be used in the regular economy in a legal way. Is that an oversimplification, or is that kind of what's happening?
Well, that's one part of it. That's when a criminal organization needs to cleanse its money to try to hide where it comes from. It's also, too, that you have throughout the globe, you have a shadow banking system where different cash is transferred in different ways. And sometimes it's just that an organization or group doesn't want it known that it's the source of the money. You see this especially in terrorist financing, that it isn't necessarily that they got the money illegally, but they want to try to hide their identity. And, of course, the key to all this is, and really the core in money laundering is, you want to make it look like a legitimate transaction, whether it comes from an illegal source or whether it's from a group that is certainly suspicious.
I would imagine that the advent of more or less internet banking, where wire transfers can take place pretty much instantaneously, has made things even easier for those who are trying to hide transactions.
That's certainly the case, that money flows across borders now much more easily than it did certainly 50 years ago and probably 20 years ago. That people think about money as cash, but in fact the vast majority is not cash, but it is credits and debits, ones and zeros in computer systems that get transferred between banks. And what's key to all of it, of course, is that can you get access to it quickly and be able to hide who you are? And that's very important in any kind of money laundering scheme. You've got to hide the identity of the person involved.
And in order to expose the identity, you have to have cooperation not only between banks but between countries. And there are so many countries in the world, and each of them has its own banking regulations, and some are more lax than others. And so I suppose, just like corporations go hunting for states to use to incorporate in that have the most advantageous laws, Delaware, for example, those who have want to hide transactions or launder money are going to shop for countries where banking laws are lax.
Well, certainly. I mean, that's where you hear about these bank secrecy havens. And even some of the famous ones that have very much changed their ways, say Switzerland or the Cayman Islands, that the money has now flowed to other locations where either their laws are much laxer or the regulatory officials are willing to turn a blind eye to it. And, of course, this can be quite lucrative for a country that's struggling economically. You've got, the money launderers, the drug organizations, terrorist financing groups. They're not going to raise a lot of objections when they're charged fees, when they're asked to pay a little small amount in taxes. It's not like they're going to come out and say, well, please, find us a bank that will take our drug business. So when they find a helpful location, they tend to stay there until the government really starts to crack down on them.
Okay. There are according to one article I read, as I was trying to get bone up, I guess, educate myself about money laundering, there's kind of a three-step process to this in terms of particularly when we're talking about cash being introduced into the financial system. You've got placement, where the cash actually gets in the front door or the back door, more likely. And then there are a series of financial transactions, rather complex ones, that camouflage the source of the money, and I believe that's called layering. And then once you've done all that, the last step is you acquire some wealth that's generated from those transactions, which is called integration. So the end game here is when the money's all cleaned up and it's got its good clothes on and can walk about, it gets invested in legitimate enterprises, businesses, real estate, that kind of thing.
Absolutely. And one of the things that came out of the recent Senate Permanent Investigation Subcommittee hearing on HSBC Bank was that you had money being laundered and then being invested into the horse racing industry. And you know, any industry can be a target, but what the money launderers prefer, or the organizations that need to launder their money, is they want to get it into something that looks legitimate, but they can also then continue to run their cash through it. So you're right that this is done in different steps, and when you're talking about cash, and certainly the drug trade generates quite a bit of cash, is what you have a challenge is of what are called bulk money transfers. That, you know, that's a lot of tens and twenties and fifties and hundreds that have to get moved, and of course that's going to be suspicious. If you come into a bank with a suitcase full of cash, that's going to send off a lot of bells and whistles. You've got to find a way to get that cash moved out of the country, into the system, and then transferred around. It's really quite complex and quite a challenge.
Well, I don't think people understand how little we really use cash anymore in the regular economy. I resisted having credit cards for a long time, and this is kind of a minor point, but I resisted having credit cards for a long time, even when I traveled. And so I'm in a hotel, and I take out a large roll of bills to pay for my hotel room, and I got a lot of funny glances from clerks, and I finally realized that they assumed that the reason I was carrying all this cash is that possibly I was doing something illegal. That isn't what caused me to finally get a credit card, but we don't think about that, and cash, large amounts of cash of any kind, now look suspicious.
Well, absolutely, and the old phrase is that cash is an orphan. You don't know where the $20 bill or the $50 or the $100 came from. I mean, it is completely fungible, whereas with the requirements now for credit cards, for example, or if you want to open a bank account, you have to give your driver's license number. You have to give all sorts of identifying information. It's because of a series of rules that have been imposed. It's called KYC, Know Your Customer. And so the credit card companies and the banks have to know who their customer is and get that kind of identifying information. So when you put your credit card out there, the government would be able to trace who that is. The government doesn't particularly care about your $50 or $100 transaction, but they might care about a $50 or $100,000 transaction, and they're going to want to get that information and see where did the money come from and where did it go to. So cash is really... it's very important to the illegal organizations because it's an orphan, but it's also very hard to deal with. If you talk about $1 million, that's a lot of cash.
But is cash completely anonymous? Aren't there serial strips inside each bill, or am I mistaken about that?
There's no way to trace it at the moment. What they've done is they put into the bills strips to make it harder to counterfeit it. We don't have RFID tracking on cash. And at one time, there was some talk about trying to show that cash was related to the drug trade by seeing whether it had traces of drugs on it, cocaine, for example, to show mm-hmm. that it was part of the street trade. Unfortunately, they did a study, I think it was of the Federal Reserve Branch in Miami, and it turned out 90% of the cash there had traces of drugs on it. So, you know, that just... cash remains the orphan. If we ever went to a cashless society, then it would be a bit easier to crack down on money laundering, but still would likely be unsuccessful.
Well, there you brought up the HSBC appearance before the Senate committee, investigating committee recently, and they were really taken to task for some things that they were involved with, not just involving the Mexican drug cartels, but international terrorism. Rogue states such as Syria and Iran were basically making use of loopholes and things and lack of oversight, apparently, by HSBC in terms of how it runs. It ran its Mexican subsidiaries and others. And so this money was ending up in the U.S. economy. And it shouldn't and it shouldn't have been. And it caused the resignation of at least one HSBC executive who said, yeah, we blew it. We may have followed the law, but we didn't exactly do what we were supposed to do in terms of oversight. How does as I understand it, in Mexico, for example, there are these currency exchanges. And oftentimes these are small businesses. And this is the first stopping place for the drug cartel cash. It goes to these currency exchanges, and then they get the money into banks. Supposedly, the Mexican government has been cracking down on this. They've passed some new banking laws. But have we really seen any real effect from all of this? The United States has been doing investigations for years. We're apparently trying to fight the drug war by cutting off the cash, but we haven't been very successful so far.
It's very difficult, and certainly the Mexican government is trying to crack down. The problem is when it's been ingrained into the banking system, and people are willing to take payoffs, that's very difficult to root out. But the other way to think about it, too, is that I think about cash is also a little bit like water, that water flows through the path of least resistance, so that if the Mexican government is successful and the Mexican banking system is successful on cracking down, the money launderers and the drug organizations are going to look for another location. And are they going to find it? This can be so lucrative, especially to a country that is very poor, a third world country, that it's really very difficult to be entirely successful. So in that regard, we're always going to have money laundering. It's always going to take place. The question is, can you make it more and more expensive? And as the costs go up, the drug organizations and terrorist financing groups will find it more difficult. And I think that's the real hope of the authorities in the countries, that make it hard to do business. Now, the United States is an attractive location because we have a very solid banking system, and we're the source of a great deal of wealth in the world. And so everybody wants to get into the U.S. to get access to our banking system.
We're talking about money laundering today. It's a big problem in the world, and some estimate that we're talking about trillions of illegal or illicit dollars. What's being done about it. If you'd like to ask a question or make a comment about our topic this morning, here is how you can do that. Three different ways to get in touch with us today. 800-486-8655. That's the toll-free number. Good anywhere. Well, I think it's not good in Australia. You'll have to send an email. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And you can also find the Kathleen Dunn Program on Facebook and leave your comment or question there, and I'll share it with our listeners. So again, 800-486-8655. I'll be back with more of our guest in just a moment. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. It's 21 minutes after 9 o'clock. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Here's what's coming up a little bit later on the Ideas Network, and this ought to be a fun hour. Well, everybody loves a good list and a good fight about music. Earlier this summer, Rolling Stone magazine named the greatest 500 albums of all time, an update to their 2003 list. This coming up at 3 o'clock. This afternoon, part one of Wisconsin Public Radio's conversation with Christian Horde of Rolling Stone. Ben Marins starts it off, taking on the pre-1980 albums on the list. And then tomorrow, Veronica Rickert talks about records released after 1980. So coming up after 3 o'clock this afternoon, they'll be talking about the top 500 albums of all time. Wow, that had to be tough to name. I'm sure we all have our favorites. Well, you can talk about that later today. This morning, however, this hour, we're talking about a more serious topic, money laundering, and the implications of all this illegal cash around the world and how it infiltrates back into the so-called real economy. And maybe that's not the right term for it, but it'll have to do for right now. My guest is Peter Henning, professor of law at Wayne State University. He also writes the White Collar Watch blog at the New York Times. 800-486-8655 is the number to call to join our discussion. There is a line available for you if you'd like to call right now, or if you prefer, send an email, talk@wpr.org. You can also post to Facebook, look for the Kathleen Dunn Show page, and you can post your comment or question there. Professor, let's take a phone call. We'll start in Verona and hear what Robert has to say this morning. Robert, good morning.
Hi, good morning, John. Say the query that I have for the professor is, in his studies, does taxation have a chapter? It seems like it's an opportunity to have a brand new excise tax that would be extra lucrative in addition to canceling all this criminal activity that is that some people are that tend to enjoy. My question is, what about just avoiding all drug laws and have all drugs be legal? Use some of the excise tax to treat people who are overindulgent, and just sort of bite the bullet on its over the counter type of problems for society, as opposed to dealing with the backroom problems that we're talking about right now.
Thanks, Robert. Professor, legalizing drugs the way to go?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting point, and it's a something that's been raised for a number of years. I'm for certain types of drugs, I'm very doubtful that you would see legalization. You know, for heroin or cocaine, highly addictive narcotics, or any number of narcotics like methamphetamine are manufactured illicitly and then just sold locally. Certainly for marijuana, there's been a lot of talk of legalizing it and taxing it, and that would take some of the access to drug profits out of the system. I guess I just wonder whether we want to have the U.S. government or the states dispensing heroin. I think that's probably a non-starter, but it's certainly an interesting idea to try to, if you regularize it, for example, it was done in gambling. We now have lotteries in most, if not every, state. But, of course, that hasn't necessarily impacted illegal gambling. It's just become another way in which people gamble. And I doubt you would get rid of the drug trade or the illicit drug trade, but it would be a source of revenue. It's an interesting point. I doubt whether we would see, you know, certain highly addictive narcotics made legal and then taxed.
Robert, thanks for the call. Speaking of revenue and so forth, one of the things that I uncovered as I was reading some articles about money laundering is that during the recent banking crisis in 2008, for example, there were banks weren't loaning money to each other, and this caused some massive problems in liquidity. And so where did they turn? They went to, for example, in Italy, they went to the mafia because they had tens of billions of dollars that they were ready to, they could shell out and legitimize by putting it in these banks to help prop them up. So in some cases, you know, the banks turned a blind eye to a lot of this because they were strapped for cash and the criminals were the ones who had all the money.
Well, I mean, certainly that, you know, if you can't get a loan from a legitimate organization or a bank, you know, people go to payday lenders, and then when worse comes to worse, you go to the loan sharks. And in a sense, that's what some of the banks did. The money laundering does serve, I don't want to say it's a salutary or a good purpose, but it does inject liquidity into the system. And the numbers you had quoted earlier, you know, 3-5% of the world's gross domestic product is tied to illegal activity. That's a lot of money, and that's a lot of money being injected into the system. And so it's, in a sense, the banks are, to a small degree, addicted to it. They need it so that the money continues to flow through the system, and the credits flow back and forth. Banks make money by taking it in at a low rate and lending it out at a higher rate. And the money launderers are often, because of the security that they want for their cash, are happy to put it in a bank at a low rate. So, you know, we can hope to get rid of money laundering, but ultimately, in a lot of ways, the system depends on, at least to some small degree, that there be this access to cash, this liquidity.
Let's hear from Linda in Monroe next. Linda, good morning.
Good morning, John. Good morning, Peter. Great program. The problem with our banking system is the lack of banking regulations, not too many regulations like the Republicans are advocating. Now, like an article that I read in The Nation of Change, they need enforcement to prosecute the bankers that got into laundering the drug money and subprime home loans. Now, the worst is probably how bad the LIBOR scandal involving Barclays, where Tim Geithner said he informed the regulators in England twice. They claimed he didn't. Now, somebody has to regulate and prosecute these criminals.
There's been some call for more regulation of how banks operate in connection with this money laundering problem, hasn't there?
Oh, that's certainly the case. You have it's the term that's used is AML, anti-money laundering, and every bank has an infrastructure now for to deal with the AML issues that come up, and they're very detailed regulations. What's interesting and a little troubling about the HSBC inquiry, there's talk that the bank will be settling with the Department of Justice and no doubt paying a substantial fine. But what I haven't heard anything about are individual prosecutions. You know, it seems that the bank, the organization, enters into the settlement or the plea agreement with the government. We saw it in the LIBOR area with Barclays, but no individuals. And I think it's a fair question to ask. Are any individuals going to be held responsible, or is this just a cost of doing business? HSBC shows up, gives its mea culpa to Senator Levin and the committee, pays a large chunk of money, although a very small amount compared to its revenues and profits, and then moves on and says, we're not going to do it again. That's very frustrating. And will we see prosecutions? You know, you see lots of low-level prosecutions. Bank tellers and things like that, but not many executives.
Yeah, well, I don't even want to go down that road. Wachovia is another bank, which is now owned by Wells Fargo, that has been implicated in money laundering, particularly related to the Mexican drug cartels. So it's not just HSBC. There are lots of banks that have been identified. Wachovia is one, and there's a whole list of banks that have been either, as some of them claim, well, we were taken advantage of, we didn't know about this, we weren't looking closely enough, blah, blah, blah. Some of these protests strain credulity.
Well, certainly that it's, you know, because it can be so lucrative. And, you know, when you see one of your, when a bank sees one of its foreign operations doing particularly well, you know, the impetus to take the profits, take the money and run, if you will, is very strong. You know, these can be cash cows for banks because the customers are willing to pay high fees and don't demand large interest rates and, frankly, are not very demanding. That there is an impetus on one side in the bank to do it, and that's at the same time, and in fairness to the banks, they do take compliance seriously. They have put a lot of resources into this, certainly in the last 10 years. And in fairness to them, that you know, this is not something that's going to be cured overnight. You're not going to root out this problem, ultimately, never. It's always going to be there, but they are trying to get better at it. But what happens then is every once in a while you get one of these blow-ups where a bank just ignores what happened in the Mexican operation, or you have this issue, and this came up with HSBC, but a number of other banks where they do what's called stripping. They take out information about the wire transfer so that it can't be traced to North Korea or Iran or Syria, because it's lucrative. You know, the push for profits is very, very strong.
And sometimes there's even a question of how to prosecute some of this stuff, because it's happening, in metaphorically speaking, international waters, and who has jurisdiction can be a really sticky question.
Well, the U.S. money laundering laws are intentionally now, since the Patriot Act that was adopted back in 2001 after the September 11th attacks, they are deliberately as broad as possible. If the money touches the U.S. shore, if it comes through a U.S. bank, a U.S. correspondent bank account, anything like that, theoretically federal prosecutors can go after it. The problem is, as you'd mentioned, you got to get the people, and they are often not in the United States. And so, you know, the banks that are headquartered here are going to be quite willing to, you know, cooperate and work with the government, but can you get that foreign branch manager, the foreign individual who was involved in this? That's a real challenge.
What was it about HSBC's dealings specifically that drew the attention of the Senate?
Well, it was that it went on for a number of years, and it crossed so many different lines. You had both the Mexican operation, but you also had the stripping out of information at the bank, and what appeared to be at least the bank turning something of a blind eye to it. And as often on Capitol Hill these days, it also gave the Senate a chance, or the Senate committee, a chance to point a finger at a federal regulator. That seems to be the common sport on Capitol Hill these days. In this case, they criticized the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, the primary regulator, to say that, look, this was a bank that was allowed to operate, and you saw the problem and ignored it. I think that's what got under the Senate's skin, was that this wasn't a one-time deal. This wasn't an aberration. This wasn't something that got shut down quickly, that this went on for a while.
Well, you mentioned that sometimes banks will turn a blind eye to some of this because it is so lucrative. And apparently there was a case in England where there was a whistleblower who pointed out that a lot of this stuff was going on, and this person was eventually fired. They reported it to law enforcement. They reported it to a number of places, and no one was paying any attention. There's a lot of, it seems to me that there's a lot of wink, wink, nudge, nudge going on. Yes, we hate all this money laundering. Meanwhile, we're taking it, we complain about it at the front door, but we're taking it in the back door just as fast as we can shovel it in. It all seems rather disingenuous.
Well, there's always the feeling that you're watching Casablanca, where, you know, you're shocked that there's gambling.
Right.
Here are your winnings. You know, that the banks can't stop everything. Anti-money laundering is, in a lot of ways, a culture. Can you keep it from, you know, becoming something that is commonplace? And what happened at HSBC and has happened at other banks, too, is that it becomes commonplace, at least for a while. Now, what the mea culpa will be, we've taken strong measures. We're going to stop it in the future. Look at how many global banks there are. Can we rely on the banks really to put a stop to it? I hope we can, but sometimes I wonder whether we can really be successful in this area.
800-486-8655. If you have a question or comment about money laundering, that's what we're talking about this hour. 800-486-8655. Email address talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And you can leave a comment or question on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page as well. Let's go back to the phones. And Jeff in Vermont Township. Jeff, good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, I'm trying to, I love the show, by the way. But I'm trying to drill down a little bit more to understand where specifically the money is coming from. And I guess I mean by geographic region. So I don't know if your guest would know this, but I'm trying to compare, say, the British Columbia marijuana trade, well known to be highly lucrative, particularly in the United States, versus the cocaine cartels of South America versus, say, the heroin cartels of South Asia.
I don't know the dollar figures for that, but what happens is really that the drug organizations tend to rely on professional money launderers, and so that the funds that they are generating, there are different ways to try to move it through the system, as simple as trying to hide it on freighters that are going to come out of Vancouver, for example, to try to get it to a location where you can do the bulk money transfer, but then finding ways to get it into the system and get it invested. So what there really is this shadow banking system or a money laundering system that in a lot of ways is like a weed. If you pull it in one place, it's going to pop up somewhere else. But, you know, the drug organizations themselves, whether they be in British Columbia, Northern California with large marijuana operations, or the Mexican-Colombian drug cartels, that what they're good at is the manufacturing side. Frankly, from a straight economic point of view, they're the ones who produce it, and then they have to create their own banking system that tries to take advantage of the legitimate banking system.
Jeff, thanks for that call. One of the ways the drug cartels, we're kind of picking on them. They're an easy target, but one of the places where illegal money goes, particularly cash, would be businesses that are very cash intensive. And we alluded to this earlier, but I assumed casinos would be a real attractive option because they handle tons of cash, literally. But I also read that parking buildings are a way to filter illicit cash into the system.
Certainly. I mean, in fact, the casinos at one time, now this goes back a number of years, were a prime way in which organized crime laundered its money. If you watch The Godfather Part II, you can see why they're out in Nevada. That has been in the United States, has largely been gotten rid of. The casinos, because of the heavy regulation, but any business in which you have a lot of cash flowing through parking structures is one good example. Local liquor supply stores, liquor stores, but also the supply operations where you're going to have a lot of cash and carry. If you see that, it is a potential front for money laundering or a potential investment. Because, you know, the nice thing is, I mean, if you think of it, if you watch one of the old World War II Stalag movies where the prisoners are digging the tunnel and they have to hide the dirt, that's what you're doing with money laundering. You got to hide the dirty money with the clean money, and any business that is cash intensive is one that is going to attract investment for money laundering and be used as a front if possible.
And we touched a little bit on this earlier, but I think the point bears restating. What's the incentive for a government to want to work hard to shut down the money trade when the illegal cash helps infuse its economy, particularly at a time like this when the world economy is once again teetering on the edge of recession? This just has to at some point become too attractive to resist.
I think that's the case. Certainly you'll see it with some countries, but what happens is that if you're the developed nations, United States, European nations, have cracked down on it, and what the threat has been from the United States, and this has been particularly effective, is if you are willing to allow the money launderers in there, either explicitly or by turning a blind eye, we will shut you out of the United States financial system. And that's a very powerful tool, and the Europeans will shut you out of the European financial system. It's going to make it very difficult to operate. So it is the nations that allow it also have to be careful not to let it get too big. You never want to become Gotham City in the sense that we'll take anyone's money and do anything with it. But there is a lot of pressure on those nations. This is an easy way to stimulate your banking sector and get liquidity into your own system when you're not able to generate it through your own domestic gross domestic product or through your exports. Cash is a product, and that's the way you have to think of it. It's just like anything else that gets manufactured. It can be used, and it can also be abused.
800 486-8655. That's the number to call to join our discussion here about money laundering on the Ideas Network. 800-486-8655. Talk at WPR.org is the email address. And you can also join us on Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Show page and leave your comment or question there. So again, 800-486-8655. Lines are available for you right now if you want to call in. 800-486-8655. We're going to take a short break. I'll be back with more with my guest and your calls in just a moment. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of WPR. It's 9:43. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn today. Coming up next hour, we're going to talk about super PACs. Not just what they do, but kind of the genesis of the discussion was an article about some rather silly super PACs that are meant to be political satire. But we're going to have a serious discussion about the role of super PACs in the upcoming elections, how much money they have, where it comes from, and all of that. We'll talk about that after 10 o'clock this morning. This hour, we're talking about money laundering. And my guest is Peter Henning, professor of law at Wayne State University. He also writes the White Collar Watch blog at the New York Times. 800-486-8655 is the number to call. If you get a busy signal, send an email. Talk at WPR.org is the email address, or post on the Kathleen Dunn Show Facebook page. Let's go back to the phones, and to Madison we go. Brad is next. Brad, good morning, and thanks for joining us.
I've got a question about corruption that may underlie some of this. So here's an analogy, and I'll be quick with it. At Penn State, somebody blew a whistle, 10 years ago, but the incentive to not follow up on that was strong, and then it blew up on Penn State, right? So a few minutes ago, you talked about someone in Britain who tried to blow a whistle and, eventually lost his job at the bank. To what extent is... Are there problems with that kind of institutional corruption, in the UK, in Bonn, in New York, that is allowing this to continue?
Well, it's a terrific question. And also, too, when you talk about corruption, I think that where you see when money laundering flourishes in some countries, you also have a culture of corruption in the local government. That bribery is almost a way of life. But in companies, whistleblowing is so difficult because quite often, as we've seen, it costs people their jobs, or at least is it's not something that helps to advance your career initially. There is, I guess, and maybe I'm too much of an idealist here, but I am hopeful that companies are starting to view whistleblowers as not something to be shut up and shunned, but instead that you want people reporting internally, and you want to take those reports seriously. That said, we've seen any number of examples in which internal reports have simply been ignored. You go back to Enron and Sharon Watkins, or more recently, not in the money laundering area, but corruption involving Walmart, in which local Walmart officials said, yeah, this is something we got to look at, with bribes being paid in connection with its Mexican operation, and the company quashed it, coming back to the Penn State idea, because of the bad publicity it might well generate. Corporations, because of the powerful profit motive and the desire to maintain a good public image, will often not respond to whistleblowers, or will try to just shunt them aside. You hope corporations will change their culture, and I think there has been some change. But, are there going to be problems in companies? Certainly.
And there has been some pushback against further regulation regarding money laundering and things like this. Some have to do with how much it costs to enforce these regulations, banks always concerned about costs, and others having concerns about privacy, and so that's there is that discussion ongoing, and I think Lisa in Milwaukee has a comment or question that follows right along with that. So let's take Lisa's call now, and give her a chance. Lisa, good morning.
Good morning, if our guest is aware at all of the costs involved with banks as far as training for Bank Secrecy Act and monitoring to kind of avoid or to prevent it happening, and not specifically for losses for the bank, but what type of costs are involved with training?
Oh, certainly the costs are significant. I mean, I don't have dollar figures. It's going to depend on the size of the bank, but whereas at 10, 15 years ago, you might have had half a dozen people at a large institution devoted to anti-money laundering, that number is now in the hundreds. And the regular training that occurs, there are complaints from banks. This is a tough issue for the banks that it is costly. No one makes a profit off of compliance. But at the same time, they can't complain too loudly because, you know, who's in favor of money laundering? This is one of those mom and apple pie type issues that you have to be fully supportive of money laundering, but then resist too onerous regulation. You know, I mean, I guess theoretically you could have someone looking over every teller's shoulder and everybody in the finance wire transfer office. That's not going to happen. It is a problem for the banks, and it's a good question to raise that you're not going to get perfection. The violations are going to happen, and what you want to have in place are good systems. Good training, is that going to catch everyone? No. Is it going to stop everything? No. But at least you have a reasonable chance of deterring it and giving people a mechanism by which they can report violations. But it is a significant cost.
Lisa, thanks for that call. Let's go to Chuck in Shell Lake next. Chuck,
Hello.
Good morning.
A year or so ago, Wachovia was shut down for money laundering. Now HSBC is in trouble over it. Now, you can't tell me these people that are running this bank don't know what's going on. But at the same time, you get caught selling an ounce of pot to somebody, you're going to go away for a while. So I wonder why these people, who are probably making way more money than anybody on the street side of things are doing off of this major, major drug industry. In fact, they're at the top of the pyramid, and you can't tell me that the billions and millions of dollars going through their banks over the whole situation is unknown to them. So why is it that these people aren't put in prison while everybody else gets put in prison? All this shows is that we have the elite in this country can get away with absolutely everything under the sun, while as the little guy is held accountable all the time.
Well, Professor, you alluded to that earlier. You talked about tellers going to jail, but the executives paying a fine and walking away. Clearly, there's a lot of frustration out there with the way that justice is not served in a lot of these cases.
Well, there was an old phrase back long ago when I was involved in bank fraud prosecutions that we always joked the best way to rob a bank was to work for it. Don't ever walk in with a gun. You'll go to jail for 5 years automatically. And that is a frustration that you have executives who are layered. You have so many different levels of middle management that to show their knowledge and to prove a criminal violation, essentially you have to show of these types. You have to show their knowledge and intent, and they will have a stream of emails saying, don't violate the law, you know, whatever you do, follow the law, and yet the pressure is there for profit. This is the problem not just in this area or even in the banking sector, but in corporate criminal violations, that can you prove the executive was involved? It's funny, you know, 10 years ago now, it doesn't seem that it was that long ago, but when Enron and WorldCom, those cases were prosecuted, you saw CEOs being charged. Either CEOs are smarter, or if you're cynical, CEOs have done a better job of protecting themselves. Senior management has, but no, it is the street corner person, the low-level person is going to get popped, and will the CEO get popped? The answer is usually no.
Well, the CEO can afford a better lawyer. Here's an email from Laura in Eau Claire who writes, I work at a retailer that offers Western Union money transfers. My question is, what responsibility does Western Union have in regards to stopping the money laundering that is obviously going on through wire transfers? When I suspect suspicious activity, I have to fill out a form and inform Western Union, but the same people are still able to send these transfers.
That has been the wire transfer business, and Western Union, being the leading firm in that area, has been challenged by that you have to get information from the customer. But, of course, the more onerous those requirements, the more likely they may go to a competitor. So it's, again, that pressure that you want to keep the business, but you want to meet the basic reporting requirements. Someone comes in and says, my name is, you know, John Doe or Sally Smith. Do you really believe them? You look at their identification, and it may look fake to you, but, you know, should we expect that somebody working in a retail operation is going to be the front line in money laundering? That's really an unfair expectation, but there it is, that the pressure is on them. And, of course, if that person's willing to take a $5 or $10 bill to allow the transfer to go through, you know, a part-time clerk who doesn't have health insurance or anything like that, you might well be tempted to take the little bit of cash to allow the transfer to go through.
Thanks for that email, Laura. Let's take a call next from Mark in Black River Falls. Mark, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for your program today, gentlemen. I'm just wondering about the Native American governments and tribal casinos. Every tribe has one, and we recently saw a former legislator sentenced to prison, federal prison up here, for taking bribes. And I'm just curious, because of the lack of oversight, maybe, that is probably not possible over a separate nation, what kind of potential is there, and if there's any information as to the, you know, depth of corruption and money laundering within tribal governments and casino operations?
Well, as far as the casino operations go, and I'm not going to pretend to be an expert, but as I understand, they have to meet the same requirements, even though it's a sovereign nation. They have to meet the same reporting requirements as any other casino, you know, Las Vegas, Atlantic City, wherever it might be. But there are issues, again, that, you know, how well is the system working? What types of banks are they working with? And, of course, you have the separate issue of corruption, of any kind of illicit payments being made. But as far as the casinos are concerned, at least as I understand it, they're subject to the same requirements as any other casino. And casinos are designated as financial institutions. And once you're called one of those, you have the reporting requirements. More than $10,000 in cash, suspicious activity reports have to be filed. All of those obligations that are imposed on other financial institutions are also on the Indian casinos.
Mark, thanks for that call. What is it that we can, what can we do about this, do you think? Or some have suggested, well, you know what, it's already too late to do anything. It's here, and we're all basically down the tubes. Do we need tighter laws? Do we need better international cooperation? What's it going to take to, if not stop this, to at least rein it in further?
Well, you know, I wish I had a silver bullet, but certainly international cooperation. I'm suspicious of adding new laws and new regulations, unless there is a new form of money or ways to transfer it. I think the laws we have on the books are good. It's really a matter of reporting, the transparency aspect of it, and the international cooperation. Because cash or money, I shouldn't just say cash, because money can cross borders so quickly and easily, that money can go flooding into a country and then wash out just as fast. That really what's needed is the kind of monitoring that will allow for tracing of funds to see, you know, where's it coming from, where's it going to. But you'd alluded to this a little earlier too, John. There is a privacy aspect to this. You know, do we want the governments of the world snooping into everybody's bank account? We don't have much privacy as it is, but do we want even less privacy? That's an interesting question, an interesting policy point.
Well, at some point, I guess you have to measure the harm against one harm against another, and decide which one is which one's the most onerous. I mean, at the end of the day, that's how most of these decisions are supposedly made. We have to weigh. There's no perfect plan. You have to kind of weigh one bad idea against another bad idea. Apparently,
I think that's right, and it's privacy is not mentioned very much in this discussion. Because, you know, once you raise the specter of terrorism or drug cartels, everyone kind of says, oh, my goodness, we have to do everything possible. Everything possible comes at a cost to individuals.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your time today, Professor. It's been a fascinating and educational discussion. Thanks for joining me this morning.
Well, thank you. Can I put in a plug for Sticky Fingers by the Rolling Stones?
Go right ahead.
For the album. Just, top 500 albums, that would be my...
Oh, okay. All right, gotcha.
Just for
okay.
Later this afternoon.
Yeah, all right. Well, you can tune in and register your opinion then, I guess. Peter Henning is professor of law at Wayne State University. He also writes the White Collar Watch blog at the New York Times. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. Another hour to come. Stick around. It's the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.